Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. Today I'm going to be looking at Stephen Norrington and David Goyer's 1998 superhero slash vampire film, Blade. Before I do that, I want to give a brief shout out to a guy who just designed my new logo. His name is Tim Graham, and you can find him over at timgrahamdesign.com. That's timgrahamdesign.com. And if you've noticed, Sci-Fi on Screen, we got a slightly new logo, much cooler looking, I think, better graphics, better font. Anyway, Tim designed a bunch of things for me. I picked one out, and I love the new look. So again, a huge thanks to Tim Graham. On my Facebook page, I link his site, and at some point, I'm going to get a link to his site up on my main sci-fionscreen.com page as well. So if you're looking for any kind of graphics or logos, definitely check Tim out. He's awesome. Okay, so let's get into some early background on Blade. I don't know much about the comic book character, so I just wanted to do a brief overview of the character of Blade itself. Blade was introduced as a supporting character in Marvel Comics' The Tomb of Dracula number 10 back in July 1973, and it was written by a guy named Marv Wolfman and penciled by a gentleman named Gene Colan. Colan recalled back in 2003, quote, "Marv told me Blade was a black man, and we talked about how he should dress and how he should look very heroic looking. That was my input. The bandolier of blades, that was Marv's idea, but I dressed him up, I put the leather jacket on him, and so on," end quote. Colan based the character's features on, quote, "a composite of black actors," end quote, including NFL football star turned actor Jim Brown. He initially sported a 1970s-style afro and wielded teak-bladed knives. Blade appeared in most issues number 10 through 21 of Tomb of Dracula, with additional appearances in later issues as well. He bounced around other people's storylines, and then in July 1994 to April 1995, he debuted in his first color comic series, Blade the Vampire Hunter. So he's been around for a while, and I didn't know anything about Blade until this film. So I haven't read any of the Marvel comics with Blade in them, but probably due to the popularity of Blade, the film, he's kind of stayed on, and there are Blade comic books now fairly continuously. I don't know where it's at right now. Comic book readers out there will probably know more about what's going on at the moment. But I think even Goyer wrote some Blade comics after the movie at some point. So anyway, a little bit of background on the character. And a little bit of background on the film as well. Marvel Studios had developed the film as early as 1992 when LL Cool J was interested in playing the lead role. And then Blade eventually, of course, was set up at New Line with David Goyer writing the script. According to Goyer, New Line originally wanted to do Blade as, quote, "something that was almost a spoof," end quote, before Goyer himself convinced them otherwise. By 1996, Snipes was attached to star. And when Goyer first pitched the idea of doing a Blade film, the executives at New Line felt there were only three actors who could possibly do the role: Snipes, Denzel Washington, and Lawrence Fishburne. But to Goyer, Snipes was always the perfect choice for Blade. Mark Singer of Beastmaster and V fame was the original choice for Whistler. Jet Li was also offered the role of Deacon Frost, but opted to do Lethal Weapon 4 instead. So it was directed by a guy named Stephen Norrington, and Norrington's track record before Blade was a film called Death Machine in 1994, which was kind of like a exploitation flick. I think that's all he had did before Blade. Goyer had written the Van Damme film Death Warrant. He wrote Crow, City of Angels, the sequel to The Crow. And he also wrote Dark City, which came out, I think, the same year Blade did in 98. So interesting, Goyer was really, it's amazing that he's really been one of the guys who's been really part of the renaissance of comic book movies and getting them up to where they are today. And I'm going to talk a lot more about that as I go, because I think Blade's a pretty important film in the sort of history of comic book movies and where films were before Blade versus after. So it's amazing Gore was involved in this and Dark City, which was very comic book looking, and also, you know, the Batman trilogy with Nolan. So I want to talk a lot about where I think Blade comes in terms of the history of comic book cinema, but I'm going to save that for the end of the podcast because I want to get into the film first. And after I finish talking about it, then I kind of want to go into a little side story about, you know, where comic book films were before Blade, what I felt Blade did, and who I felt now has benefited from Blade and The Matrix, frankly. The two movies were, to me, such watershed moments in comic book-ish cinema. So anyway, I will get to that at the end of the podcast. Okay, so let's jump into Blade the film. So we start out very, very ominous, very dark. The titles of the film are in red. There's some ominous music coming up. And we open in 1967, and they desaturate the colors to give us kind of a feel of the way, you know, films looked back then, which I think is kind of clever. And we're right into the action. We open up in an operating room as this pregnant woman is brought in with a bleeding neck wound. And it's very realistic, lots of blood. You know, one thing I will come back to over and over again as I talk about Blade is the fact that it was rated R. How that R rating helps to make Blade kind of, I don't know, like a movie that's got a little more grit than you might expect for a comic book movie. We get this really intense hospital scene where they're trying to save the mother's life and they fail. We see a child delivered. So the child lives as she dies. And they cut it out of her via C-section, you know, and it's just a great opening. You're like smash bam right into this thing. Very much made me think of the Warsaw Ghetto opening of X-Men, which is, I think, is another landmark film in comic books. And if you've listened to my X-Men podcast, you'll hear me talk about kind of where I think it fits in the pantheon. But definitely I feel that even in this early setup that you're getting a very serious opening, and that this is kind of a big deal for comic book movies to open this gritty and this realistic, even though Blade's kind of a slash horror movie as well. But again, and I've said this probably over and over again, if you're a longtime podcast listener, that, you know, whenever you, the more speculative your universe, the more you want the audience to take these leaps of faith, you know, as they go through the movie, the more you need to really ground the bloody thing in some serious realism when you start, you know. And I feel like, you know, Singer really did that with the first X-Men film. Nolan really understood that in the beginning of Batman Begins, which is set in, you know, Chinese prison. And I feel like here as well, you're getting the audience into something realistic and you're not being asked to take a lot of leaps yet. And what you get is the feel like the filmmakers are serious. They're taking the material serious. They're trying to impact you. You know, they really want you to feel intense by the film. So just all good setup here. So then we get these great opening credits. We go into full credits and we're looking at an unnamed city. We never really know where we are with Blade. Doesn't look like any city that I know of. Amazingly enough, it was mostly shot in LA, and I lived in LA for a while and I did not recognize it. So anyway, I thought they did a good job of not having it be named as a city. So you're not looking around for landmarks and, you know, so on and so forth. So, but what's great is that the time-lapse photography, the camera catches the shadows as they deepen, and they seem to rise up and sort of engulf the buildings, which is just really neat. I don't know. I just thought it was a really very artistic opening. And then we go to full darkness and we see the lights come on. So we're in, you know, and the soundtrack, again, Mark Isham. I'm not a huge Mark Isham fan. I don't find myself drawn to Mark Isham soundtracks, but this soundtrack is so like John Carpenter-esque. I think Isham is channeling Carpenter, and it's really great, and it really does a lot to make the film an intense, dark experience, you know? So it's really great, and we're getting that right from the beginning. We're really in this film. I don't know. It's just really like an incredible mystery so far, and we're, you know, we're not even like 3 minutes in. The action opens. We're in a car with, if anyone knows, this woman is former porn star Tracy Lords driving, and some young, really young guy she's picked up in the passenger seat, and they're flirting, and, you know, she's taking him somewhere that's a surprise, and she gives him a sidelong look that he doesn't see, but we, the audience, see, so we know something dangerous is going on. We cut quickly to her and him walking through a meatpacking plant with all this hanging meat, foreshadowing, obviously, visually, as she's kind of bringing meat to the party, as it were. And there's a brief moment where the kid sees something being kind of wheeled over, wheeled through this plant, and he looks at something, and we get a very, very quick glimpse of it. You really can't tell what the hell it was. And it's not until you get to Blade Trinity that you realize it's the beginnings of the sort of final solution where human beings are kind of put in stasis and used as kind of human blood bag. It's interesting that it's right in the beginning of the first Blade movie. One little note, the doorman in this scene, as they get close to where the party, the rave is being held, the doorman is actually, I think at the time, Tracy Lords' real-life boyfriend, is this really big, cool-looking dude. And so they enter this nightclub, and it's a great production design. This techno music is blasting. And it's mostly the song Confusion by this band New Order. And it's great, man. I mean, it's really like, you know, it's classic. You're in a club, lots of strobes, right? But it's cool, you know, and the music is great. Shot with lots of style, lots of super cutting. I don't know if that's the title, the name of it, but like we're introduced to these slow motion shots of characters and then cut to another one, another one in a way where we kind of get visually introduced to them in this cool way. And one of the characters we're introduced to is Mercury, who's this blonde sort of European woman who we will come to hate as the movie goes on. So we see her in the dance club. As this kid gets into the club, he gets pushed around. All of a sudden, no one's very friendly, and he's getting knocked around, and people are looking at him strange. So he finds himself in the middle of the dance floor. We see all around him as the music starts to rise up to this crescendo. All people around him, their hands are going up in the air. It's a beautiful scene. They're just slowly rising up around him. And then when the music hits this big crescendo, the blood coming through the sprinkler system rains down, and all these people start to now turn a little bit into vampires. Their fangs come out. We hear some roars, and it's amazing scene. The blood bath, as it were. Really, really great scene. Just vampires have been around for so long, and we've been doing books and movies and comics about vampires, and I thought that was a pretty new thing, like kind of a technological innovation in terms of seeing vampires that play and what they do. So just, I thought, very ingenious by Goyer. And of course, this kid's about to become a feast, but Blade enters, and it's like, this is the entrance of all entrances for any kind of hero. If you're an actor and you want to be a big ass hero in a film, you know, you could do worse than entering the way Blade enters here. The kid's getting beat up and he gets thrown down on the ground and he slides forward. And in the foreground, we see this boot, and then he looks up, and then the camera goes down to his point of view and slowly pans up, and we see Blade from like ankle height, and he's just like completely badass. Like, it's ridiculous. And everyone in the club looks up, the music goes down, and we hear these whispers, Daywalker, Daywalker. Of course, we don't know what that is yet. And then, you know, Blade walks forward smiling. He pulls a weapon, and the first person to move on him is shot. And immediately we see how these vampires die when they're killed in certain ways. They completely disintegrate. Their bodies just kind of completely go to powder and to pieces, and they've, you know, collapse on the floor. It's really neat. And they do this, you know, they keep this pretty consistent throughout most of the film. And the techno music now cranks up when the fight kicks in. And it's amazing, you know, seeing this now, and I'll talk about this near the end of the podcast, that Blade and the Matrix came out within a year of each other. And they're so similar stylistically. It's really amazing. Like, something was happening, obviously, in the zeitgeist, because the Wachowskis had just finished filming The Matrix when Blade came out. And Blade was filming, you know, 2 years before The Matrix. Neither one saw the other's movie, but man, were there so many similar things. And, you know, to start out this movie with Blade doing martial arts where we're not cutting away and it's not a stunt double. It's Wesley Snipes, and he's practiced, and he actually is a martial artist as well. And we have the techno music and the martial arts stuff going on. Like, it's amazing that this is kind of, you know, the bar on action movies of all kinds has been raised with this scene, I feel like. So, more cool stuff. He's got this shotgun that shoots these steel spikes, so he's killing vampires. And he's got hand spikes strapped to his thighs like bandoliers, which he also uses. And it's an amazing fight. And the camera's tracking Blade through the strobes. And they're not cutting away. I don't feel like they're doing blizzard of cuts here, so I can follow the action. And they really stay on Snipes when he does his moves. And they'll do that through most of the film, which is really cool. It's very visceral and not confusing, which is, I think, a very fine line to walk in films like this. And, of course, Snipes is a martial arts practitioner, and he just moves really well. You know, he pretty much takes out the first wave of vampires who are against him. Now the rest have kind of taken off. And now we meet Quinn, who's our sort of number two bad guy in this movie. And he's got a cadre of guys who I guess are, you know, a little more fight savvy. So they come at Blade with these crowbars. And now Blade draws his sword, which he keeps in the scabbard in his back. I believe it's like titanium and silver. So there's enough silver in it to actually kill the vampires when he impales them. So, but there's no cross guard. It's just a straight up sword. So really neat. The whole thing is taking place in like a slaughterhouse underground. So he jumps into this huge pit full of tiles, the camera swirling around him, and all these guys are coming at him. And it's a great fight. You know, it gets a little goofy at one point. He smiles and then throws like a bladerang, as it were, and he takes out three vampires and it comes back to his hand and he smiles. So the comic book stuff is kind of coming in a little bit now. But so he kills them all and then he pins Quinn against the wall with two spikes. I never was sure why Quinn doesn't die here, but I guess you have to hit them in the heart or the head at some point. But he didn't look like he hit them. He was hitting them all in the heart with, I don't know, it's a little bit of a continuity thing at this point where I'm like, really, he didn't vanish? But Quinn's speaking in some weird language we don't know, which I think is a cool little touch. You know, we'll find out later on, not directly, but it's some kind of ancient vampire language, which I think is really cool. And so we realize that him and Quinn have this sort of relationship where he doesn't kill Quinn every time he encounters him. You know, he does something to him that's really painful. So he lights him on fire at this point. And just as he's leaving, he comes across the kid who was originally brought to the club, takes one look at him, realizes he's human, and then he's gone. And then the cops arrive. So, hell of a bravura opening. And the last shot is a camera panning up on an alley, and Blade walks out of a back door into the night and gone. You know, it's a really cool. The first time I saw this, I was like, you know, what in God's name is this? What is going on, man? This is amazing. Just a very surefire opening. Quickly, though, we get back to kind of realism in that Quinn's charred corpse is brought into a lab, into a coroner's office, you know. So we're back in a medical facility, and we meet Karen Jensen, who's one of the protagonists of the film. I like that we meet her in this way because it's logical that Quinn's body would be brought to a place like this. She's a hematologist because she works there. So she's a specialist in blood, which plays into the film really well. And it's a clever way to get a blood specialist into the film, because when the main doctor autopsying Quinn takes a look at his blood, he notices this, something's off and something's weird about it. So he brings it to her, who's a specialist. And it's like, what a very sharp way to just get her to be who she is in the film. And they're using medical terms such as, you know, these cells are binucleated, blah, blah, blah. Who knows if they're real or not? But again, it sounds real. It's really cool. Then they're both standing over Quinn as he's on this table, and he comes back to life and bites the neck of the male doctor. Chases Karen out into the crowded hallway, and he gets to her neck, and he does bite her. But at this point now, we flash to Blade coming down the hospital hallway, and we hear him say, "Came back to finish you off," which, you know, it doesn't make sense. If he likes torturing Quinn and leaving him till the next encounter, why is he coming back to kill him? So whatever, a little bit of a nit here. But Norrington has dazzled me so far that I'm so on board. So Blade cuts off Quinn's arm, and as it falls, Karen's on the floor and the arm falls right in front of her and vanishes in front of her. So she sees some of this stuff firsthand, which will allow us to go with her when she kind of buys into the whole vampire thing later, and you know, a little bit further on in the film, because she's seen some really crazy stuff. So this is a funny scene. Two cops arrive and they unload on Blade because they think he's the bad guy. And he turns around and he's like, "Are you out of your MFing mind?" You know, it's kind of a cute scene. They turn around and run away. But in that moment, Quinn escapes, falls out of a window into an ambulance, freaks everyone out in the ambulance, and then runs out into the night, you know, holding the stump of his arm. And then Blade comes back for Karen. So he's about to leave. And then he turns around and he looks at Karen, and we get a little bits of flash of what his mother looked like, you know, so it's possible that he has some memories of being cut from his mom's wound. So there's obviously some kind of sympathy there, and grabs her. So he grabs her and runs into this room and smashes out a window and heaves her across the gap between buildings. And then he follows and he jumps in a very similar way that Trinity jumped over the gap of buildings in The Matrix. The camera doesn't do as much of a stylized move as it does in The Matrix, but it's a very similar scene that they're out and over and he lands on his feet. So it's just, again, with The Matrix comparisons, it's very interesting. There's this cool thing. He opens the door to protect he and Karen as he goes down the steps, and we see these bullet holes impact and kind of appear on the door in slow motion. It's a cool little moment, you know, just cool little, very great detail. And a film that has a lot of great details. So now we get this wonderful moment of like there's a montage of buildings from a very low angle as Blade's driving, sort of Karen's point of view as she's like, you know, half delirious in Blade's car. We hear this weird kind of Middle Eastern chorale music or chant music and a very moody and dark soundtrack. We see Blade driving, and then a big wide shot of the city as it flows into day and the sun rises. So wonderful, wonderful opening sequence. So now we return to, as I like to call it, the Blade Cave, because I think a lot of what Gore did on Blade ends up in Batman, or it's kind of a dry run. Or, you know, he's a huge comic book fan, so I'm sure things are bleeding over here and there. It's really cool looking, very realistic. It's in some warehouse district, of course. And we meet Whistler, who's his sort of weapons master, kind of his Alfred, as it were. Christopherson's great here, man. He's just an old grizzled dude who's been doing this for years, and he really comes off as very authentic. The smoking is a little kind of a put-on. I feel like when I see him smoking a lot, it seems a little put-on as an actor. Like, sometimes it seems natural with certain characters, but Whistler smoking a lot in this is sort of like, and of course he has lung cancer, but it's a little bit of an artifice, but he's a really good character. Reminded me of John Voight in Heat, sort of who is Neil McCauley's kind of like go-to guy who set up jobs, you know, the older guy who just looked like Walking Death. Anyway, Whistler doesn't look like Walking Death, but he's really cool looking. And we hear Bad Moon Rising, which has probably been in every vampire movie ever made, from a Creedence Clearwater Revival on the radio. So then we have this moment where he injects Karen with this liquid garlic solution, and we see this little puff of smoke on her neck. And then he's like, I give you 50-50. But what I like here is they use the technical name of garlic, or the medical name, I guess, which is Allium sativum, or sativum, however you want to pronounce it. I think this is where Blade makes that turn into modern comic book movies, by trying to make it very realistic. To me, this is the first time I've ever seen vampire media of any kind where they're starting to take the notion of blood and what are the chemicals in garlic. Obviously, it's an antibiotic, right? But they're actually trying to put a little scientific spin on it to make it more than just the boogeyman, you know, like they're trying to get it realistic. And I feel like this alone leads right to Batman Begins, you know, where how so much of Batman is rooted in realism, if not real itself, ultimately, but rooted in things that are real and that do work in the world. So I think it's really cool. And I like the way it sounds when he says Allium sativum. You're just like, ooh, what's that? Oh, garlic has another name. I don't know it. What is that? You know, you go to Wikipedia, you look it up, there it is, you know. So just really like it. It's these kind of small details that, for me, I'm always like, the writer really, really got layered in the material. So then we cut to the vampire elders. You know, it's sort of the vampire nation sitting around this big conference table. They're looking over photographs of what Blade did at the nightclub. And the main guy who's leading them, Dragon Eddie, is played by this guy Udo Kier, who, if you saw him, you'd know him. He's been in 1,000 genre movies and otherwise. Second banana in this crew is an actor named Judson Scott. I forget the name of the character here because it's kind of a throwaway. But Judson Scott was Joachim from Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, who dies near the end, and Khan says, "I shall avenge you." He's also the star of a very short-lived series in the 80s, which I really loved, called The Phoenix. It came and went with a blink of an eye. But anyway, Judson Scott, for anyone who cares. And now we get our main bad guy who enters, Deacon Frost. And Dorf is great. He looks very alive and intense. Like, he definitely looks dangerous, which, yeah, Dorf usually does. He's a kind of a face where he always looks kind of mean in a weird way. I don't feel like he's 100% in this character, but it's a solid performance. And, you know, I feel like this is definitely a guy that Blade has to be careful of, you know, and I think that's what it needs to do. Then when he comes in, the elders start to speak about Blade in sort of this vampire language, so we're getting subtitles on the screen, and I didn't do any research. I don't really know what it is. It's probably like Romanian or something. It's another little detail of, like, these aren't just these, you know, they come from a deeper, darker, more ancient place. You know, little hints of that are, you know, they're going to come later too, but like, the language is this, they speak this ancient dead language. You know, Deacon Frost is researching this old book. There's mention of the Book of Erebus, the Vampire Bible, thousands of years ago, you know. So, again, just gives the vampires a little more weight. They're not just these blood-sucking bad guys. Like, there's a whole culture. Everyone, you know, that the human beings know they're there. We're sharing the planet with them. So, there's a kind of let alone, let live policy between both sides, you know, which we now hear the plot that Frost is basically like, we should rise up and take these people down. They're our food. We should be ruling them. Where the elders are kind of like, you know, for thousands of years, we've kept the peace and we've lived in harmony with human beings and, you know, been left alone. And of course, Deacon Frost wants to change all that. And we find out here as well, there are two kinds of vampires. There are pure bloods who are born vampires, so I guess they have children. And then those are bitten who are human and turn into vampires are called those who've turned. And the pure bloods kind of stick it to the non-pure bloods whenever they can. Dragon Eddie being a pure blood always kind of, you know, hits Deacon with it, like, you know, you not being a pure blood wouldn't understand. And Frost is very much like, and like it even matters, you know. So there's this conflict going on between them, which is kind of cool, actually. They would, you know, backstories like this, I think, make vampire films a little more interesting. Like Underworld, which I didn't love. I felt like it was an incredible Matrix ripoff, but they really thought through the story. The vampires versus werewolves history, and you know, when stuff like that is in the movie as throwaway lines, or you get the sense that there's a larger thing going on here that's outside the film, I always feel like it gives the film a little more weight, you know. And it's not just some BS film where everything's in the film, everything's on screen. We're being hinted at that there's a lot of other stuff that you're not going to know about that's gone on before and that's outside the movie. And I don't know, it gives Blade a little extra oomph to it, which I think works well. Now we're back at the Blade cave. Karen wakes up from her sleep. She's in Blade's room, and she looks around, and we see that he's got a little meditation couch. He's got these books on Eastern religion. And she goes in this workroom where his sword is up on a stand. She touches it, and then hears some little mechanism working and moves her hand, and then these four little blades pop out of the handle. And we realize anyone grabbing the sword and, you know, that's not Blade basically is going to have their hand completely severed apart. And of course, the rule of three, as Goyer is a huge fan of, he'll take something in a movie that has import and he'll introduce it, and then he'll use it once, and then he'll use it for the third time. And the third time usually has a lot of importance in the plot. And so for the sword, the first time the sword goes into action in terms of the handle is here. The second time a vampire picks it up and it actually severs his hand. And the third time is at the end of the movie when it's in the rocks and it activates and it drops the anticoagulant bandolier into his hand. And so you've been brought there by Goyer because you've seen this thing, you know, go off three times. So subtle little trick in the movies about, especially look for it in comic book movies, any kind of gadgets or things that are going to play an interesting part in the movie tend to go by this called rule of three. So of course, you know, Karen freaks out. She tries to get out. They block her. And then we've got a bit of exposition from Whistler. And we get the information that he and Blade are vampire hunters. They travel around, kill vampires. We get the rules of the world so much that there aren't really religious aspects to repelling vampires. Whistler says crosses and holy water don't do squat. You know, wood stakes in the heart, silver, garlic, those, and sunlight seem to work. And we hear another name called Hominis Nocturna, which is, again, another quasi-Latin medical name for the vampires, which kind of keeping in using garlic's Latin medical name. I like it. And so they tell her that, you know, vampires are actually everywhere. They're all around, and she's probably seen them, just not known it. But now that she's been exposed to their world, they're going to take her out. So they give her some vampire mace. It's kind of a goofy scene. Whistler hands her this little thing. He's like, what's this? He's like, a vampire mace. It's just, the movie owns it, right? But it's a little goofy, like, vampire mace, really? You know, they leave off, too, that, like, you know, if you find that you're, you know, uncomfortable in sunlight and you're thirsty all the time, no matter how much water you've drunk, it means we didn't catch the bite in time, and she's going to turn and become one. And Whistler says, best buy yourself a gun and use it if you need to, whatever. And then we have this wonderful moody moment where Blade's driving her back into the city. It's a montage with no sound, and we get like a Carpenter-esque soundtrack cue underneath it. Again, you know, night is coming. It's getting dark. They're bringing Karen back to the city, and, you know, we're getting back into our gothic feel, which is really neat. Then we cut away to sort of a vampire archive, the Vampire Nation archives, and Frost is there, and we see that he's using some kind of computer program to analyze these ancient scrolls and texts for a purpose we know not what of yet. And Dragon Eddie comes into the archive and confronts Frost, and so Dragon Eddie tells him the ancient texts are untranslatable. It's a dead language. And they face off briefly, but Frost kind of just stands his own, and he grabs him, and he's like, what are you going to do? And Dragonetti takes off. So we realize at that point that Dragonetti and the Council really have, they're kind of, their power is really waned to the point where Frost is really the comer in that nation, you know? So now we get a little bit of tension as Karen's returning back to her apartment, and we've been set up that she is going to be, you know, the focus of the Vampire Nation. These two kind of sinister-looking characters are standing behind her in the elevator. When they walk forward, she sees they have these kind of curious tattoos on their necks. We don't know what they are yet, but we'll find out very soon. And the suspense is very solid because we don't know who's who. And so the two people on the elevator follow her out, and she's reaching for her mace at one point, turns around, and they're gone. So a little misdirection. And so in her apartment, she's visited by this young cop who's been waiting there. You know, ostensibly he says, hey, you know, you've been missing for 2 days. We're looking for you. But then he quickly, you know, turns and realizes that that he's going to kill her. And he pulls his gun and she uses the mace on him. And he laughs and he's like, what is that, garlic? You know, I'm not a vampire, bitch. You know, and he's about to shoot her when Blade appears out of nowhere and pretty much beats the crap out of him. And then we get a bit of an info dump from Blade talking about the term familiar. So vampire familiar are, you know, human beings who are promised to be turned into vampires. And I guess, you know, being having a lot of strength, you know, really long life, it's a quite attractive club to be part of. So they get tattooed in the back of the neck as to terms of what house they are from or who their masters are, as Blade says. Blade knows Frost's Glyph. The cop, whose name is Krieger, realizes it's Frost's familiar. So beats the crap out of him, sets him loose. They find a briefcase full of blood in the squad car, more information in that there are usually one or two blood banks in every city that are owned by vampires, and they deliver, and they use police to do the delivering. So we see in the back this whole apparatus, you know, where it's a cooled sort of case. There's blood bags in it, and obviously he delivers to whoever needs. Blade's about to kill him because he can't get any more information out of him, and Karen kind of gets in his way, giving Krieger a chance to escape. Now, you know, we get a little cool line from Blade. He's like, you know, you better wake up. The world you live in is a candy-coated topping. There's another world beneath it, and if you want to survive, you better learn how to pull the trigger. You know, does his little, his tough guy routine. And again, you know, just very thought through the vampire familiars, different glyphs, you know, and also all the art design, all the glyphs look similar, but obviously are different. So they design this whole little glyph language, which is really neat looking. Just more of the detail in this movie that to me elevates it above the usual, you know, be a horror action movie. You know, just a little bit of extra care has been taken in a lot of different ways.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, it's $4 a week, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi On Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $26 and change right now. At $50 a show, I would really like to improve the quality of the sound for you guys. And I could buy a really good microphone and a booth so you guys can get the best sound I could possibly provide. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/sci-fi-on-screen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah. No, blah, blah, blah.
They stake out Krieger's cop car. He comes back and they follow him to a vampire, a club owned by vampires. And again, we see these little glyphs in the neighborhood of the club, which Blade tells Karen. You know, and Karen is kind of like the stand-in for the audience now. These glyphs tell vampires that when dawn is coming, there's a safe house nearby that they can be safe from daylight and, you know, hide out in. So he tells them that he knows vampires by sight, the way they move. He gives her a gun and tells her, you know, anything but the head or the heart or it's your ass. So, you know, very hard to kill. There's this great club scene. Blade busts in and the scene itself is really bizarre. The only people in the club are these old Asian men in like sunglasses, smoking cigarettes. And they're watching this rap group of like pubescent young Asian girls in like schoolgirl skirts singing or rapping on stage in Japanese. Like it's just such a weird thing. I think it's so cool because it's very uncanny. Like you know, as he's kicking ass and coming after Krieger, we're hearing these weird women rap in the background and, you know, these Japanese men are just looking around. Like it's just a wild scene. Again, like the Blood Club, just a real flair for certain types of places that Blade's going to go, you know, not your just average BSB movie club scene, just a little bit different, you know. We see now Blade really in action again, and again, Snipes' moves are so wonderful. He usually, whenever he's intercepting a punch, he's already ready with a counter move, so made me think of Bruce Lee's martial arts style called Jeet Kune Do, which he called the Way of the Intercepting Fist, which is like when practicing moves that you're not blocking an opponent, you're actually attacking as block. You know, like your opponent's strike towards you is the beginning of your attack towards them. So I feel like Blade kind of has that kind of style where usually the move that he intercepts, the whether it's a kick or a punch, is combined with an attack move in this 1-2 quick way. That's amazing, you know, and it's consistent through most of the movie. Like, he has all these quick 1-2, you know, block attack moves that are his style. So, and you see them really well shot here. So he corners Krieger, beats the crap out of him again, and we find that an entrance to some strange safe house is in the freezer. So it's not, you know, Blade opens the freezer door and we see actually steps leading down. And so they hit the main vampire archives, which is kind of like pay dirt for Blade. And at the same time as, you know, they go inside, Karen and Blade go down, we cut now to Frost at his ridiculous rooftop penthouse with this cool trip-hop music playing in the background. And there's a pool on the roof and, you know, they're having this great party. And Quinn is talking to these girls, wait till you meet this Frost, man. Wait till you meet Frost. He's really cool. We see that Frost has completed his translation of this text, and it begins to display this sort of animatic, which is this circular chamber with these figures, and each has a different glyph on it. And we see, you know, this lightning shooting down, so, like, you know, something's coming. And, you know, savvy genre fans, we know that somehow this is going to be part of the climax. At the same way, Krieger is killed by Frost. He rips his neck open, basically. And there's a ridiculous, I like to call, bad guys are really twisted scene when Frost and Mercury, his female second banana, they sort of making out and they're like tongue kissing and licking each other's face. Krieger's blood's all over them and it's just like, you know, could you be any more of a bad guy than that? Then Quinn gets the information that Frost wants Blade alive, and Quinn's like, dude, we've been trying to kill this Afro for years and now you want him alive? Come on, man. He's flipping out, you know. Poor Quinn, you know, he doesn't get much in this movie. So back at the archives, we're introduced to this massive vampire that's like, you know, a 500-pound person kind of spread out on a mattress. Really, really huge in this weird kind of childlike voice. And she's the record keeper. And Blade now is part of his arsenal. Whistler has given him this UV light, which when he shines the UV rays onto a vampire, burns their skin instantly. So Karen has the light, and she's basically playing it over Pearl and torturing her, you know, pretty much to death at this point, to give up information about what Frost is up to, because Blade sees the animatic that we just saw that Frost saw. So he's getting a sense of, like, you know, Frost onto something. What is his plan? And we hear something about the prophecy about the awakening of something called La Magra, the blood god, and Blade takes the data tape of the recording, and Karen winds up killing Pearl. So then they enter the archives proper, and it's really cool. These pages of what it looks like, pages of this old, you know, book have been torn out and put in between these pieces of glass and hung up. You know, really ancient kind of place, ancient museum, as it were. Really neat. And we're told that the pages are from the Book of Erebus, the Vampire Bible. Again, more kind of larger than the movie info, which I love. It contains the book, supposedly contains their entire history. And then suddenly there's movement. Quinn arrives with a bunch of fighters and with Mercury, Frost's second banana. And after some battling, Blade's taken. There's just too many of them, and he's surprised too quickly. And Blade and Karen are taken. And definitely, again, more great fight moments as Blade is attacked. Not a lot of cutting away. We're seeing the moves completely on camera, which is really cool. Really good fight choreography. Again, you know, so much of the turn into 21st century comic book and action movies was happening with the Blade and Matrix. You know, really, really actors who were trained to fight and then cameras catching all of the action without cutting away. So it's really them. I'm sure you could turn up movies where you saw this before. Obviously, you know, martial arts movies starring Chuck Norris and Seagal and guys like that. But in comic book movies and shot the way it was shot, like even the old martial arts movies showing those old guys, they weren't shot as cool as these movies were. Was really highlighting the moves and the action. So, again, just, you know, always want to just throw in there how I think influential Blade and, of course, The Matrix were when they came out. So we have a little bad guy posturing. Blade's being held. Quinn does a little bit of a monologue. This is where another guy grabs Blade's sword, doesn't know about the safety catch, destroys his hand, and Quinn sticks two of Blade's metal spikes into his shoulder. And then Whistler comes in, with explosives, takes out the wall and this huge gun. Great line, catch you effers at a bad time, you know, and we're off. Then we have a brief chase scene where they all escape into the subway. Whistler kind of goes on his own, and it's basically Blade and Karen. Bomb goes off back in the archives, killing most of the vampires, destroying the archives. Blade pretty much kills the rest and then waits on the other side of the tracks as a train goes past, so he and Karen make it over. Some pretty cool action work. He and Quinn are fighting while a train is going past. He cuts off Quinn's arm again, and he sends Quinn running, and before the rest can get on him, he grabs onto the rear of the train as it goes by, and it pulls him away, and he's got Karen with him. And then they do something really interesting. They're in the back of the train. They've escaped. His arm is dislocated, and it was sort of similar to when Karen's arm was dislocated earlier, so of course she puts his back in place. But, you know, in a lot of superhero movies and movies like this, Blade just would have been able to do that, and it's no big whoop because he's Blade, and not too many people would have questioned it, but it is kind of a crazy superhuman feat to be standing and grab a subway going by and not to be hurt by it. So I like that he gets injured, that he actually gets hurt by this feat, that it's not costless for him to do. It actually costs him something, which to me makes him just more of an interesting hero than some Superman who can just kind of do anything, you know. So anyway, it's a small detail, but I think it's really cool. And he needs a serum at this moment. We see him jab himself with it and basically passes out. I think Karen gets him back home.
So while Blade recovers in the other room, Whistler tells Karen a bit about Blade's background. And we hear the story about how Whistler found him on the streets scavenging for blood, not really knowing what he was. And we hear exactly what his powers are and that his mother was bitten when she was pregnant, creating a hybrid daywalker. So he has all of their strengths and none of their weaknesses, save for the thirst. So he can walk out in daylight, and he's not susceptible to silver sunlight or garlic, obviously. But he does need blood. So we hear now the serum that keeps the thirst at bay, but that he's also growing more and more tolerant of it. And at some point, we're getting hints that it's not going to work. He also ages like a human, so he doesn't have their near immortality. It seems like vampires age much slower than human beings do. And then Christopherson gives a great little monologue here about his family's death and that a drifter came calling on his home, a vampire drifter, and tried to tell Whistler to decide which order they would die in. And he doesn't go into too much detail, which I think is good because we can do the rest in our heads. And it's a solid little monologue, some nice delivery. And I also like that, we don't hear much about Blade until up till now in the movie. So from the opening of the movie until now, Blade exists in kind of a mystery. So Whistler talks about his family's death, about a drifter coming calling to the house and taking them all hostage and torturing them and asking Whistler, what order do you want your family to die in, so on and so forth. And what's great here is that I like it takes half the movie to find out the mystery behind Blade. So we get this mysterious figure who's our hero in the film, but we don't know much about him. We don't know what his backstory was or why he does what he does or even what he is. Which is nice. It kind of leaves us most of the movie to have Blade exist in this mystery. And then we finally get a reveal of his backstory, when we've had a good measure of him in the film. So I think that's a really good job that the film does there in allowing us to sit in mystery for a while. Then we have a bit of a scene between Blade and Karen, and she tries to sort of talk him down from his perch of vengeance. And that Blade explains, and he's setting up the ending of the film here, he explains that he's been looking for this thing that made him what he is and that killed his mother from all his life. And that every time he kills one of those things, I get a little piece of that life back. So it's very much the Batman, you killed my parents kind of anti-hero drive. And it's great. Nothing revelatory, but it's a solid setup. It's a bit neat of an ending that how things are going to turn out at the end. But, it's a superhero film and this is kind of what these films do. And it's solid. Then there's a creepy scene, which is really well thought out and kind of cool in its creepiness, where Frost and his crew kill Dragonetti, the head of the vampire overlord. And again, Frost and his girlfriend are the couple everybody hates. We see them in the car just before dawn, putting on sunblock and gazing longingly at each other and kissing and stuff. And we just want them both to die very quickly and very gruesomely as soon as possible. Frost confronts Dragonetti. He's being held by all these other men. He pulls out his two teeth So the two kind of vampire, I guess, incisors or whatever they're called. And then they stake Dragon Eddie to the ground, and they all stand around him in these black clothes and gloves and motorcycle helmets with sunblock on. And just as the sun comes up, they all close the visors of their helmets, but allow Dragon Eddie, as a pure blood vampire, to take the full sunlight on himself. And it's a really gruesome scene, as it takes a long time for him to die. He kind of melts first, and then he explodes into dust. Back at the Vampire Council, when asked where Dragon Eddie is, Frost throws his two teeth on the table, and then basically, with his henchmen around, basically takes the council hostage, and we'll find out why a little bit later on. But at this point now, Frost is in control of the vampires, at least in this city. Back at the Blade Cave, we see that Karen has brought a bunch of equipment from the hospital. She wants to work on a serum for Blade, or possibly a cure for Blade. There's also this neat bit of science. Now, again, they're ingesting science into this previously supernatural realm, where she says there's an anticoagulant that she's been playing around with called EDTA, which I looked up, which is a real substance that will react intensely with vampire blood. So she puts a little drop of it on a slide and steps back, and the thing blows up. So again, the writers did some research about blood, more real-world science, and the fact that, you know, an anticoagulant would be used as this weapon against vampires, again, gives Blade an extra layer of depth, making it more than just kind of your basic vampire movie, which I love, you know. And again, I really think so much of what Goyer did here was a template for Batman Begins. At one point, Whistler's coughing his brains out somewhere, and Blade and Karen are there, and we find out that Whistler has cancer, so that he is dying. And we also find out that the shot that they gave Karen of garlic the night she got bitten didn't take. Her wounds hadn't healed, and Whistler says, "For what it's worth, I'm sorry." So we're not sure what's going to happen to her at this point, that she will soon turn into a vampire. So at this point, Blade leaves the cave and goes downtown to get some serum. And I don't really, this scene is really weird. He's confronted by Frost in broad daylight. Frost is standing outside with a little girl in front of him as a hostage with sunblock. And it's a ridiculous moment, number one. Really, what's happening here is Blade should be distracted while Frost and his group are back at the cave getting Karen and killing Whistler. So I don't know how Frost can be in two places at once, but they have this bad guy talks to the good guy dialogue. Obviously, Frost is just trying to lull him into submission so he can capture him. Blade's response to him is, "You're nothing but another dead vampire." And rather than being able to kill Frost, because Frost throws this little girl in front of a truck, and Blade saves the girl in a really, really well-shot scene. The camera's kind of in front and focused on the little girl. And we kind of sense this truck coming up behind her. And, you know, Blade dashes in and grabs her at the last minute. Really neat. And he unloads a few rounds at Frost. And it's interesting that we get our first instance of bullet time about, you know, 6 months before The Matrix was released. And that we see these bullets kind of forming these strange paths. Because Frost can move so fast, it slows down time. So, again, just the relationship between the Blade and the Matrix is such a strange one. Obviously, the Matrix was in post at the time that Blade came out, and you just wonder, like, did the Wachowskis see this and say, "Holy shit, you know, look at that, like, he's dodging bullets." Or was that already in the Matrix script and that they already have that planned? You know, you never know. And at this point, you're never going to get a straight answer out of anybody. But I like, you know, it does humanize Blade a little bit. I mean, obviously, Blade's been humanized because he saved Karen at the outset, but he also used her as bait, which she could have easily died. So Blade's very kind of a harsh character. Here, when he saves the little girl, you know, it definitely cements his status as a full-on superhero. Good guy, because he gave up, you know, killing. He would have easily been able to kill his nemesis, we think, but rather save this girl from the truck. Then back at the cave, it's still just Whistler and Karen, and we get a little more of science about vampire anatomy and the notion of what vampires are, which again I really love. You know, Karen's talking about trying to come up with either a serum for Blade or some kind of cure for herself now that she has contracted what she calls a virus. And her and Whistler talk about, you know, why do vampires drink blood? And they say, you know, their own blood can't sustain the hemoglobin, which I think is a critical element in blood and blood cells. You know, just again, it's genius. Like, there's a little scientific, notion of why these creatures do what they do. They constantly need fresh blood to replace the hemoglobin. And, you know, Karen says that some of this stuff reminds her of sickle cell anemia. And it's possible, like, you know, gene therapy back in the 90s was all the rage, the late 90s. It was going to be this miracle cure. Obviously, it didn't quite work out as they thought. But so she's like, you know, we can cure this like we cure other things with gene therapy, and we can, you know, so on and so forth. So she concocts something for herself to try to cure it. And right after the shot, Frost and his crew now enter. They finally found the place where they hid out. They capture Karen, and they beat the living daylights out of Whistler. And Blade returns to the cave much later and finds Whistler, you know, basically under a bloody sheet, which is kind of a gruesome scene. Again, an R rating. They're allowed to kind of go a little further than normal. Whistler's barely hanging on. He's been bitten by several vampires, so he's just bloodied. And, you know, worse comes to worse, he'll turn if he's left alive. Blade finds out that Karen is a hostage, and that Whistler has kind of deciphered somewhat Frost's plan, and that his blood is the key, and that Blade is the chosen one, and so on and so forth. And at this point, I felt like this kind of hero's journey crap wasn't necessary, like Blade was the chosen one. I kind of get it thematically, like if he was a vampire, or if he didn't hate vampires so much, he would have been this interesting daywalker character where he would have sacrificed himself to become this blood god and lead vampires against human beings. So that's kind of neat. And the fact that he chose to walk the path against vampires is that, you know, he's a reluctant chosen one. So yeah, it's kind of clever, and I give Gore credit for it. But when I hear that word chosen one, you know, it's been so overdone. Instead of any kind of hero's journey, you know, genre movie of like, oh, he's the chosen one, she's the chosen one, that I'm kind of tired of it now. And I feel like this film was lean and mean and had its own thing going, that it didn't need it, you know, that he just could have been one. He just, that the, you know, the experiment needed the blood of a daywalker, meaning maybe he wasn't the first of his kind, that there's been others like him that have lived it throughout the years, and he was just the latest one or another one. So I don't know, but the, you know, you hear that chosen one stuff, and I'm like, no, come on. So, but anyway, it's a nit. So we have an apparent death of Whistler, and that, you know, it's a pretty intense scene. The soundtrack cue comes up. These old friends who've been fighting vampires for years, and Blade walks down the corridor, and the camera stays with Blade, and we hear a gunshot in the background. And of course, we know that you know, Blade 2, that Whistler will return, and they kind of do a pretty good job of it, and that the vampires captured him and threw him in sort of like a blood stasis. And, you know, hey, these are genre movies after all, so you can kind of do what you like. But I like that Whistler does apparently die in this film because it gives it a little more stakes. It doesn't make it just so clean and easy for Blade to kind of do everything, you know? And there's a videotape that Frost left giving them the location of where to come. Obviously, Frost has concocted his bad guy super lair there to do his thing and, you know, become this blood god. So there's a bit brief battle prep. We get some nice, you know, again, some of that Middle Eastern sort of vocal music, and it's very quiet. We see Blade meditating, and then at one point in slow-mo, you know, kind of like a montage, he gets up and knocks over all of the Zen implements that he's meditating in front of and cuts the root out from the plant that he's meditating in from. I was always wondering if that was some kind of martial arts symbolic thing that you do before you're going into battle, you know, cut the root off a plant, and that, you know, you may not come home, and it's symbolic, but that's just me. I have no idea. But I like it, you know, like all this meditating and clearing his mind. Then it's like, you know, he's now embracing chaos, and he's about to go ape. Then a brief scene where Blade and Karen and Mercury are just sitting around waiting for Blade to show up, and there's a brief back and forth between Karen and Frost, and Karen is like, you're nothing but a virus. You're not a pure blood. Where'd you get those scars? A real vampire would heal himself completely. And then Deacon Frost opens up about kind of about what's about to happen. And, you know, believe it or not, there's a lot of cursing in his little bad guy monologue, and it kind of undercuts what's going to happen. He's like, everyone you've effing loved, it's all going to be effing history, effing this and effing that. And it's kind of like a little adolescent for him to be such this badass bad guy, to be F-bombing like that. It actually, to me, diminishes the power of this final little speech. So it's interesting to me. I've never kind of witnessed that before in a motion picture where I thought, hey, the bad guy's cursing too much and it makes him seem shallow and kind of not as powerful. But it was, I don't know, it's kind of interesting. Then we have our end game, our beginning end game. Blade enters the compound via motorcycle. smashes through glass, and basically it's on. The music kicks up, and he's just going crazy now, massacring everyone he encounters. And there's some great martial arts moments when he enters the place proper. Through these skilled attackers come against him, and they have these stun sticks with these blue tips, so they look cool as they're being moved around. And we see him use these new anticoagulant weapons, which Whistler has fashioned into these sort of, you know, what would normally be like a tranquilizer dart. And instead of the tranq chemical, the anticoagulant is in there. He uses it on both of these two vampires and they explode. And it's really hideous detail. And at the end, when he's striding past them, we just see these two eruptions of blood come from off screen. So very cool, you know, tough guy action movie moment. And thank you, Rated R, you know. So he wanders around. Obviously, he's being led to wander around. And the revelation is that some woman that we have seen, we haven't seen her, I think, fully her face up till now. This woman who kind of seems to be Deacon Frost's main squeeze. And it turns out to be Blade's mother. And he is completely stunned. And we find out that Frost is the vampire who bit his mother way back in the day. And that Frost is the being who sent him on his journey and, you know, so on and so forth. And that she turned immediately after he was born. She did die, but then she wound up turning anyway. And at this point, Blade is so psychologically damaged that he is taken by everyone. So there's a brief little scene after this where Blade and Karen are tied up and thrown in the back of this van. I guess they're being taken to the place where they're going to perform this ritual. And we hear that Karen's made a serum that worked. So whatever she injected herself with actually cured her. And she tells him, you know, here's the thing. It might work on you because at this point he needs his serum. He's getting weaker and he hasn't had a serum in a long time. But she says, look, if I give you this shot, if it works on you, you'll be completely human and lose all of your strengths and advantages, which is a great dilemma, which he'll kind of rule on right at the end of the movie. So now we have our real end game here and we enter this Temple of Eternal Night. Where the blood god Rite is going to perform. It's pretty cool, the cylindrical-looking temple that stretches up pretty high. Really neat. I don't get a sense that... It's odd. We're in some kind of Midwestern city like Chicago, and somehow this ancient Temple of Eternal Night's been buried in America for all these years. It's very goofy. I think I would have liked it better had Frost constructed it, where, you know, there was just something that he had to construct for the ritual, and then he had it built. Rather than saying, hey, it's been around for centuries. And strangely enough, it was right here. And it's like, really, it was built of vampires, you know, who are purportedly by most lore, you know, from Eastern Europe and a European thing. They buried their kind of blood god ceremonial chamber in, you know, Illinois. So it's a goof for sure. But, you know, it is. You go with it because it's a genre movie. So Frost, of course, has his kind of before the last moment speech. He has Blade completely in custody. And what we're told is Blade is now suffering visually from the thirst, having not had his serum. So he's in kind of this bloodthirst where he really needs to be fed. And he can't hear. He can't really respond to people. And Frost takes Blade's sword and waves it around. And we're all waiting for it to explode. But he knows about the safety catch. And again, you know, again, the sword and the safety catch, we're reminded of it. It's not in action, so the rule of three is still preserved, but we've already seen it in action twice. Now we're reminded of it this time, and then, you know, when it finally happens in the climax, we'll have our third. Frost takes a look at the bandoliers of anticoagulant, thinking that it's his serum, and of course, it's a nice moment as a viewer where we're watching them, and he throws them over his shoulder and to land somewhere else that we'll see later. And they drop Karen into a pit where the doctor that was bitten the night that she was bitten herself when Quinn's body was taken to the hospital, they say that sometimes instead of turning into vampires, that they don't make the turn completely, and some people turn into these mindless kind of cannibalistic zombies, which I felt Goyer was doing a little seed for a possible sequel, which kind of got changed in Blade 2 to something else. But anyway, it's this doctor, her ex-boyfriend, who she used to work with, and so, you know, he's coming towards her, and you know, she somehow manages to take him down and escape. So, you know, okay. And Blade now is put into this really interesting thing where these two kind of clamshells close around him. And he is basically drained almost of all his blood to make this ritual work. And it's really cool to look at while it's happening. His blood takes this course. It's drained into all these like 13 channels. 12 for the council member and one for Frost. And so we follow the, like, you know, sort of like this Rube Goldberg contraption. Very interestingly designed, very cool cinematically just to watch, like, where's the blood going? What's it going to do? So I like it. In a last moment of betrayal, his mother, you know, really talks to him, and the woman who was your mother is dead, and she's kind of flirting with him because, you know, she hasn't aged and Blade has, so they're kind of the same age. So she's really putting herself into a place where, as an audience member, we're like, okay, you know, when he kills you later, it's not going to be such a taboo that he killed his mother because you're really pretty much evil and have gone over to the other side. So then the Blood God ceremony takes place, and it's great. Really interesting to watch. They hold each of the 12 council members on one of these plinths so they can receive drops of Blade's blood. And there's this astonishing sequence where we see the course of the blood as it travels through all these channels. It's a very slow build, and we cut back and forth to the chamber where Blade is because the clamshell thing he was in opened up. And, you know, we see him weak and drop to the floor, and the ritual's going on outside. And Karen finds him. And she offers her blood because he needs his real strength if he's going to defeat these people. And he's completely drained and powerless. So she offers her blood, and he grabs her and drinks. And while he's drinking, we're cutting back to the ritual. So very smart, Norrington and Goyer, you know, how it's just the back and forth. So we're constantly, you know, in this tension of things that are happening. I really like it. So part of the ritual is that lightning strikes start this process that each council member's soul is kind of born out of its body. And it's sort of, we see out of their mouths, these creatures sort of rip out of their bodies. Like their mouths open really wide, and these creatures put their hands in the victim's teeth and just kind of pull them apart. And what comes out are these gargoyle demons that fly around. They're kind of very Ray Harryhausen-like. I think they're obviously CGI, but they're really neat. These ghouls, and they're the sort of demon souls of these 12 vampires flying around. It's an astonishing sequence to watch. Really gruesome. Again, thank you, rated R. You'd never get away with this in a PG movie. And it's really great to see. And it just, the whole Blood God ceremony was really well thought out in terms of just watching something interesting and kind of watch-like, you know, unfold on the screen. I really like it. So now Blade rises up stronger than ever. He's had real blood for the first time in a long time, and he's pretty raring to go, screaming Frost's name at every moment. And at the same time, Frost receives this last drop of blood on himself after these ghouls have all flown into him, and we close up on his eyes, and we see them slowly turn red. So something really wild is happening to Frost. And now the techno kicks in, and Blade is like out of control. So he jumps down into the center of the chamber, calling Frost's name. Quinn takes a run at him, and we get this great final death of Quinn. And Blade has this thing on his belt that's sort of a very, very thin wire attached to a ring. And so Quinn comes at him, and he pulls the ring away from his body, which extends the wire, and just basically lops Quinn's head off in one spin and then lands. Quinn's body completely disintegrates, and Blade is just kind of perched on the ground, like ready to go. Like, it's a great kick-ass, you know, taking the number two guy down scene. Really cool. And it's at this moment when the techno kicks in and he takes his glasses back from Quinn, because in an earlier scene, Quinn had said, hey, thanks for the glasses, dude. And once this happens, we start with the techno setup, and then the music kicks in and we are on. And again, it's so Matrix. So weird how these movies are similar. And he's completely unstoppable now and dispatches everyone who touches him. And the camera always lingers to catch the moves without cutting away, which is just great. And this has been happening throughout most of the movie. At the same time, Karen is fighting Mercury, this blonde woman who we love to hate. And Karen actually has been overpowered by her and is about to kill her, but uses her vampire mace on her. And Mercury takes a full load of it in her mouth, and her head completely explodes. So it's a very satisfying death. Blade finally retrieves his sword from the wall, which Mercury had used earlier to kill one of the vampires just for fun. And then he goes into, he does a couple of moves with the sword and puts the tip on the ground and kind of moves his arm out. And the camera zooms up just below to look up at him. And it's a great ass kicking, like, you know, hero of the action movie kind of moment where he's just ready to roll. It's a nice moment. And then it's Frost versus Blade. And somehow Frost has produced a sword from somewhere. And we get Frost versus Blade with swords. And it's a pretty cool sword fight for what it is. Obviously, you can tell that they're just trying to strike at each other's blades, which is, you know, an Achilles heel in movie sword fighting is that, you know, you can't do real sword fighting. Most real sword fights are going to be over in like two or three moves. So you have this, you know, exaggerated thing where they're hitting at each other's swords rather than trying to hit at each other's body and be blocked, because it looks cooler and it looks pretty good. And they cut briefly, so it seems, you know, almost faster than it is. But the camera does come back and we see that they did do some moves together as actors with swords, which is really cool to see. And at the climax of a very rapid escalating series of hits, Frost loses his arm and Blade cuts him in two at the waist. But instantly we see Frost reattach, and arm basically grows brand new, and he reattaches himself at the waist and basically says to Blade, it's too late. And Blade's kind of like, he mouths what the F without us hearing him say it, but we see him mouth it, which is kind of interesting. So they keep fighting. You know, Blade is basically fighting a losing battle at this point. And at some point, he's down and he sees that the bandolier of anticoagulant, which Frost had thrown earlier, is stuck in this crack, like right between the two of them. Frost notices it as well and kind of nods and doesn't really understand what's going on. So here we have the third of the three with the handle, and he throws his sword hilt first into the crack after having, I guess, unclicked the safety catch, and so the blades expand out into his hand behind him. It's like behind the back catch, which is like a little much, but it's fun. And he tosses the entire pack into Frost, and the last one he kind of flips up and kicks, and it impacts itself into Frost's forehead. And there's this very gruesome scene while all the anticoagulant goes to work on Frost, and he turns into this incredibly blob-like monster before he just bursts and explodes. So game over. It's done. And we quickly get to the top of this chamber, and Blade and Karen are leaving, and he says, you keep your cure, but, you know, make a better serum. The war isn't over yet, and, you know, and I need to go to work. So right after this, we're briefly out. And then there's a weird postscript that he's in Moscow, and it's snowing, and we're outside this vampire safe house. We see a man leading a woman inside in a very similar scene to the beginning of this film, where Tracy Lords was leading a man inside. And his vampire is about to kill her, and Blade intervenes, and we end just as about he's they're about to fight, and we end with this techno credit sequence very similar to how The Matrix ended with Rage Against the Machine, and then we're done. So, brief summary of Blade. I like it very much. A lot of thought went into the backstory and the mythology and the technical aspects of what vampire hunters would use and how this would work, and I think because of that, number one, you're getting a prototype for Batman Begins. And number two, you're getting a different kind of superhero movie. One that's just written, I think for the first time, a superhero movie really written by a fan of the genre. And at the same time, a pretty smart guy who knows a little bit about movies as well. So you get someone writing this who's not embarrassed by the subject matter. And he's not saying, you know, all right, we'll write a Batman movie, we'll write a Superman movie. It's kind of goofy, but he's taking it with such another level of seriousness, and he's adding science in, and he's really doing a deep backstory on the vampires as well as the antihero, you know, and there's so much Batman in Blade as well. But it's a good fit. So you have this kind of, you know, scientifically adept hero in what was previously sort of a supernatural Dracula and holy water kind of vampire world. Just a brand new thing, really, I thought. And I think, again, I'm going to talk a little bit about that now, where Blade comes in. The history of comic book movies is a really interesting place that that does a lot to what's to come. And another important thing is, because of the R rating, they can go a little further with violence to remind you that you're not in a comic book movie per se. You're also in a horror movie here. And I think, you know, like Alien was a really wonderful, where the horror really makes the sci-fi that much better. I think the same thing happens here, where the R rating and the horror aspects, where you're allowed to get more visceral in what you're doing on screen, takes you away from like men in tights and capes flying around and saying dumb things like people's heads are exploding and they're being cut open and there's blood everywhere. I don't know, you're brought into the movie in a deeper way, in a more, you know, intense way. And I think it draws you in and you're able to suspend your disbelief a little bit more because, number one, they're taking it so bloody seriously. And number two, it's kind of gruesome. And so it's coming at you, you know? So I think Blade does that. It's one of the first films, I think, that really does that in the comic book universe. So, speaking of the comic book universe, I want to talk a little bit postscript here about where Blade comes in sort of the history of comic book on cinema. Obviously, this is not going to be exhaustive because, you know, there are a lot of comic book movies out there one way or the other. But from my mind, when I think about the history of the comic book films, you know, the first significant comic book movie, and yeah, there were serials and other stuff done in the 40s and 50s with Batman, I think, and Superman. But the first movie, you know, kind of that we're used to seeing like modern films was really the 1966 Batman with Adam West and Burt Ward, which was, you know, played for farce, frankly. It was a very campy thing, not to be taken seriously. And not until 1978 do you get Richard Donner's Superman, where for the first time, I think, and I guess, you know, if I'm wrong and there are other things, then please let me know, but I feel like Richard Donner's Superman for the first time is starting to take the superhero genre fairly seriously. And they do it in two ways. I think the last third of the film, when you have Luthor and the slapstick stuff, that's not what I'm talking about, and especially the ending when he turns the world backwards. That's also very goofy and comic booky. But we open a comic book movie with Marlon Brando. I mean, you have to imagine, back in 1978, Marlon Brando was a legend. The man was like one of the greatest actors in the world. The Godfather, On the Waterfront, all these movies that Brando had been in, you know, and stage productions that were filmed. He was the man. People worship Brando. And so you start Richard Donner's 1978 Superman film with Marlon Brando as Jor-El. That was a big deal. And if you go back and read some reviews of the original Superman, it took the critics by surprise, too. They were like, it's an astonishing thing to see Marlon Brando acting. And he's taking it completely seriously. He didn't learn his lines, actually. They had to use cue cards for him to read everything. But he took it very seriously. And the Smallville growth of Superman, when once he lands and he's a young boy in Smallville, was also taken seriously about his difference and about, you know, what he could do and how that might be difficult. And I mean, when I look at the landscape, I've never seen that before, Richard Donner's Superman. You know, this was really taken seriously. So I think that was, obviously everyone realizes that Donner's Superman was a landmark. And really, I think the beginning, it took a long time to get to where we are today, but really was the opening shot in superhero movies becoming these serious vehicles to a degree, where they're actually taken seriously cinematically and not just as larks. So in the 80s, after Superman, you know, it's funny that they didn't take it too far. I mean, in the 80s, you had the Swamp Thing, Superman 2, which was kind of a very similar film to Superman. So you had that, very similar, a little bit campy with the villains, but Superman going through, you know, a serious thing of losing his powers. But then in the 80s, you know, Superman 3, you had Supergirl, where you tried to do a Supergirl movie, which I didn't see, but from the clips I've seen, it looks pretty stupid. And then in the late 80s, you had Master of the Universe with Dolph Lundgren and Superman 4. You know, not films we go back to and, you know, look at for anything interesting. Now, in 1989, you had Tim Burton's Batman, which was another landmark film. So, you know, if Superman took the comics seriously for the first time, now you have the first darkening of the landscape. And this is the first time I think a film tries to capture the darkness and grittiness about a comic book character. And arguably, it came after the mid-80s where you had you know, V for Vendetta, Dark Knight Returns, Year One, The Killing Joke. All of a sudden, this incredible turn in the mid-80s where Alan Moore and Frank Miller and other writers really got, you know, comic books kind of grew up in the 80s, really, and got dark and gritty, and they were allowed to kind of go in a lot of different directions. And Burton's Batman is a reflection of that. He doesn't take it nearly as far as the writers took it in the comic book world, but for the first time, you have a very dark set, a very dark tone. You know, that this he's kind of an anti-hero. As played by Michael Keaton, he's kind of a he's a complex hero. He's not a very clean superhero. And it's definitely taking a page from Donner's Superman in terms of seriousness about certain things. Really great casting, and as much fidelity to the source material as you could. However, you still had this campiness in that, and I think this came from the producer. I did a podcast on this a couple of months ago, and in some of the reviews, I think Burton really wanted to press the darkness and keep it going. And his producer is the one who, you know, got Prince to record some of those songs, pushed for the Party Man sequence, and, you know, the whole Joker character is really kind of absurd, Whereas the Batman character, they try to push it a little bit and make it as realistic, as dark as possible. So it's an interesting film. It's trying to do something different with the superhero genre. So then in the 90s, you know, you had films casting about, not really sure. No one really knew where to take this forward. You know, you had Dolph Lundgren's Punisher in 89, which is just a crappy B movie, which is really like a, more than anything, it's more like a bad Death Wish movie. You had Sam Raimi's Darkman in 1990. There was something happening with Darkman, but a very forgettable story for me. But there was something about how it was shot that it really looked kind of cool, and you had Liam Neeson, who was really good in it. The Rocketeer also came out that year in 1990. Very Indiana Jonesy, but and a very fun ride. In 92, you had Batman Returns, which was arguably very dark. But again, the villains were very campy, and there was a lot of comedy. 1994, you had an interesting film, The Crow, which got a lot closer, actually, adding some style and a lot of seriousness to things. And I think it was hampered by its budget and for a really bad supporting cast. It was kind of really, really B-movie-ish. But The Crow is really like, you know, it's a little half step forward from Burton's Batman, and that it's trying to really get a little dark and more serious than that, believe it or not. And the same year as The Crow is The Shadow with the Alec Baldwin. And The Shadow is a really old character, kind of, you know, a pre-Batman Batman. Again, it was a very solid B movie. They tried to do a pretty good job, but it wasn't, you know, anything, it didn't have a lot of grit to it. It was just like an okay, watchable film. And then things took a turn for the worse with Joel Schumacher's Batman films in the mid-90s, which were just drecky, campy crap. That's where you were, where Blade and The Matrix came in 1998 and 1999, respectively. So Blade came out of nowhere. I mean, when you take Blade as a film and you compare it to a lot, even The Crow or The Rocketeer or Darkman, it's a different animal. There's a different level of seriousness to Blade. And none of those films had anywhere near the fight choreography that Blade has and the weapons and how cool all the guns and the knives and all the things were. You know, the level of seriousness that Gore and Norrington took with Blade and rendering Blade on screen and coming up with all these things, it just stood out. It was just in a class by itself from all these other movies. And it's an incredible thing to witness. You know, when you go back and watch a few of those movies and get a feel for that, what was happening before Blade, and then go watch Blade, and it's astonishing to see how much that Norrington and Gore created pretty much whole cloth. I mean, let's face it, the Zeitgeist was going there. Like, someone was going to do it, you know, like someone was going to figure this stuff out. But Gore got there first. And I have to also rope in The Matrix as well, because 6 months later, you had The Matrix with all this. They added all this incredible cinematography and these incredible bullet times and the 360-degree cameras. And, you know, they even upped the game a little further with the martial arts sequences, really shooting them well. And so, you know, and I put The Matrix and Blade kind of together in terms of comic book movies, because soon after you had Bryan Singer's X-Men. And then I felt like, you know, X-Men starts with a Warsaw ghetto, you know, kind of how Blade starts in a bloody operating room. It starts in a really, really dark and gritty place. And, you know, and the thing, what I think X-Men ups the game, it takes the seriousness that was taken towards Blade and, you know, the fight choreography in terms of The Matrix. Although, I don't think the fight choreography in X-Men is that great, but there's this, but what Singer does in the X-Men films is he adds a theme. I mean, you know, the thematic exist, you know, the theme of the X-Men are these outcasts and these people who are shunned and frightened by society and come together to find each other and then, you know, protect those very people who have kind of outcast them. So you have like an actual, you know, literary theme running through Singer's X-Men film, and Singer's taking, you know, the X-Men, which is, you know, if you're flipping through an old X-Men comic book, you're like, how does this kind of goofy comic booky stuff get into this wonderful, very serious film that Singer did, where he, you know, Wolverine is dark and very brooding. He picks certain heroes, so nothing's too fantastic. The powers are taken very seriously. No one really blinks. You have great actors like Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen. And again, I feel like a lot of that came out of what Norrington and Goyer did with Blade. They were the first ones, I think, who stood up and said, you know, we can make a really cool movie about a superhero and we can take it really, really seriously And it can be dark and it can be gritty, and we can have great fight sequences, and we can actually trick out the hero with real life stuff that's only like, you know, the day after tomorrow, instead of like, you know, laser guns and crazy supernatural stuff. Really blew me away. You know, I mean, when I look at Blade and The Matrix and what they've done, and I think Blade, especially for just the direct line for comic book movies. So I just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about that and have a kind of place in my heart for Blade. And also X-Men, of these two films where I think the comic book landscape on film really turned a corner. And post-X-Men and Blade and The Matrix, you know, then Raimi's Spider-Man movies start up. Then Nolan's Batman movies start up, you know. And then we get to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and this whole thing that that blew up afterwards. But to me, from my mind, these were really kind of the progenitors of so much of that. So I normally do trivia, but I'm clocking in at pretty much over an hour. So I'm going to cease and desist, and I'm just going to say thanks a lot for listening, and I will see you next time.